You're listening to Panel Borders, the weekly podcast version of Resonance FM's shows about the world of comics. This is the first of two special podcasts, which originally formed part of an hour-long Clear Spot on Resonance, which are looking at the Belgian tradition of clear line artwork, exemplified by comic books and graphic albums such as Hergé's Adventures of Tintin, and also the accompanying trend in graphic design, technology and architecture, which is known under the broader term of the Atom Style. In this episode, I'm talking to artist Woodrow Phoenix, creator of various children's comics over the last 20 years, and recently the acclaimed graphic novel Rumblestrip. Later in the show, I'm talking to artist Garen Ewing, whose graphic album The Rainbow Orchid, Volume 1, has just been published by Egmont and brings the look and daring do of comics like Tintin to a new British audience. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
You first got into comics through the small press and Paul Gravett's fast fiction stall in the Westminster Comic Markets. How did that association first come about?
Well, it came about because the first mini comic I ever saw was one by Eddie Campbell. It was an A5 photocopied thing. It was called Blues. And I found it in a comic shop in New Cross called Weird Fantasy. And I was really intrigued by it because it was the first homemade thing I'd ever seen. And before then, although I'd thought about comics and drawing them and writing them a lot, it had never occurred to me that you could just make something yourself and just, you know, put it out. So it was really inspirational. It was also really well written, really well drawn. And I remember that it had little Tippex and hand colouring on the cover as well. So it had like all the different attributes that you'd want in something that was made by somebody. It felt like a personal product, but it still had a real kind of sheen and professional feeling to it. So it was a really exciting thing. And I can't remember how I knew about Westminster Comic Mart. I think it's just one of those things that probably I was told at one of the shops. There was also... What was it called? I think it was called Weird Fantasy? Amazing Tales? It was some kind of mini comic that had details of stuff in it. So anyway, I went along to Westminster Comic Mart and I saw the fast fiction table that was full of mini comics of all kinds. And I just thought, well, I can do this. So I pretty much just did that thing of going home and writing and drawing and using a photocopier to make my first mini comic, which was called 20 Penguins, I think.
Did it have 20 penguins in it?
It had 20 penguins on the cover, yeah. And then bringing that back to Westminster and giving it to Paul and, yeah, having the real excitement of having it on the table along with everybody else's stuff. And it was a great place to meet people. I met most people who I still know today. I met there at those marts, all of us doing the same thing, all of us making our own comics, and all of us excited to be part of a community of people who are doing this. And because the comics world was very small then, and not that much bigger now, really, everyone met each other there at the marts. So all the people who were working professionally, you know, whether it was people like Alan Moore or people like Alan Davis or Brian Bolland or all these guys, they were all there as well as people like us who were just doing mini things. So it was a great place to meet people and get talking about things and to get excited.
Well, I mean, and also I suppose those kind of people, you may have thought them as gods at the time, but I've, you know, interviewed Kevin O'Neill and Alan Davis and so on, and actually the page rate that they got from 2000 AD back in the day was actually a pittance anyway, so they were probably, like you, looking for other opportunities in the comics world. How would you describe your style back then? Because you're kind of renowned for being quite mercurial in your style, that it changes from project to project.
Well, it was the same back then, actually. Okay. Because one of my primary preoccupations is this idea that whatever the story is, there's an ideal way to do it. So I often find myself thinking about what's the best way to draw X, and rather than thinking about the fact that I have a way to draw which I apply to material, I think about what material requires, and then I find the right way to draw it. This leads to lots of problems, actually, because it means that people don't really know what to expect from me. It means that sometimes it doesn't work out that well for me because people don't know where to find me or what they're going to see. Yeah. So I can't really say that I have a signature look that much, although I suppose in recent times I've probably done more of the same kind of thing. But I enjoy coming up with different kinds of looks for different kinds of things. It seems to be the way that my mind works, generally.
Because you're in this exhibition in Brussels at the moment, the Atom Style, and in the notes for the exhibition on his website, Paul describes that the work you did for Escape magazine at the time was also influenced by the Atom Style, so presumably it's something that's influenced you and you've returned to over the years.
It's a personal preoccupation of mine. One of my favourite buildings in the world is the TWA terminal that was designed by Eero Saarinen, and it's this amazingly beautiful, swooping, kind of semi-organic structure that is kind of romantic and utopian and super technical, and it's constructed in such a way as you can kind of see the bones of it looking through the way that it's made, and it's really kind of transparent, but it really has an amazing kind of feeling to it, and it's really surprisingly intimate. Even though it's quite a big structure. And it just has a wonderful kind of poetic, celebratory feeling to it that I think is unparalleled, really. His other airport, the one at Dulles in Washington, is also kind of amazing, but it's a different kind of amazing to the way that the TWA terminal is. But that's an example of that kind of Atom Style, really. The kind of idea that we celebrate the tools and the machinery and the things that enable us to live our lives in a comfortable and interesting way by making them into wonderful objects. You know, buildings that are cathedrals, buildings that are...
both aesthetic and functional.
Yeah. I find it kind of constantly depressing how Britain is constantly dominated by the lowest common denominator kind of architecture all the time. It's like it wouldn't take much more to make... you know, our train stations and our airports and our town halls and, you know, all our public places, they could be amazing, but they're just always really cheap. You know, they're always built by the person who had the lowest bid, and they're always kind of crummy, and they're always made out of, you know, cheap materials, and they're just really not very interesting places to be in. They don't make you feel good when you're in them or anything. And when you're in France or in Belgium or in Spain or in Germany, you know, you just see all these amazing public buildings. And there's not that much difference between them and us, really, apart from they don't seem to mind spending an extra £1 a square metre on something. And we won't do it. We just won't do it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder if it's the cultural legacy of the Blitz that, you know, we came out of the war still under rationing for another decade. And so there was this make-do and mend mentality in Britain. And so it's all very well that there was the Festival of Britain in and around the South Bank in the 1950s, which promised the same sort of future that you're seeing in the architecture you like and in the Atomium in Brussels. But then we didn't really put it into practice after that sort of brief flourishing, you know, back then.
Well, I think it's probably true to say that modernism failed in Britain, really, because we associate it with council housing that falls down and with public buildings that leak and with structures that are unsound. And that's really because when Britain tried to embrace modernism after the war, they took the cheap route and they did it cut rate and they did it, you know, as quickly as possible and using crap materials. And so, yeah, it did all fall down. But the legacy of that is a generation who don't trust modern architecture and don't believe that it's going to deliver the things that they want because they've seen the results of it. So in a way, I guess you can't blame people for not thinking much of it, but it's kind of a shame, really, that just because of the cut-rate approach, that an entire kind of style, which could have a lot to offer us as a nation, has been just kind of sidetracked, really, hijacked.
In terms of your style, you've been quoted as someone who was very much influenced by the look of American Saturday morning cartoons. So I suppose, in a way, your comics occupy the middle ground between the likes of that sort of... brightly coloured fantasy that you see on TV, and also the retrofuturism of that 1950s sort of style and architecture?
Well, in Britain, we are exactly halfway between the European style and the American style. That's it, isn't it? We're in the middle. And obviously, because language means that there's a big barrier between us and our European friends, it means that all that stuff seems so much further away than it really is. In some ways, I think America is a much more foreign place than France is. But because our languages are superficially similar, it doesn't seem like that different. But it's just until when you go there, then you realise that it's a different country. They have very different ideas and very different ways to express themselves, and they think very differently to us. But it kind of seems closer than it really is. So one of the things that was good about Escape was exploring this idea that actually we have a lot more to learn and to say in common with our European neighbours than with American ones. So it was about celebrating those links and making them more explicit, I guess.
And before then, had you been a fan of European comic book art, or was it just sort of the most common examples like Tintin that you would regularly get in this country?
Well, yeah, it was Tintin and Asterix, of course, and lots of stuff that I didn't really know what it was called. When we went on holiday, I would just pick up things like you do. You just go to the nearest shop and just get armfuls of whatever you can and then take it away and feast on it. So there was lots of stuff I couldn't read because I couldn't understand the language, but I later found out about things like Blake and Mortimer, for instance. And was it Valerian who did the sword and sorcery stuff? Barbarella?
Yeah.
And things I probably shouldn't be reading when I was seven. But
I've got similar stories to tell. But I suppose the majority of your work is in children's comics. And children are actually probably the most sophisticated audience for comics because they get bored very quickly. And so their drawings need to have a clean line and a very sort of intelligent storytelling style that perhaps, you know, adults would be more forgiving with a rougher edge to their comic book art, while with kids it has to be much more immediate and much more sort of dynamic.
Well, there are lots of different ways to draw for children, and some kinds of stories are very well served by very dense, very scribbly, very textured kind of stuff. So it's not necessarily about the simple line itself, it's more about the way that you graphically arrange the elements in those pictures. I'm thinking of people like, for instance, I don't know, Jan Pankowski, who does the Haunted House books. I mean, those are really complicated and they're full of stuff, but they're very well designed, so you never get lost in them. Or going in a different direction, thinking, say, like Where the Wild Things Are. You know, those are quite dense. There's a lot there. But they're very well designed, again, so that you're never lost. I think designing your images, making sure that you know how things read, is the most crucial part of any kind of enterprise, especially when it comes to drawing for children, because you don't want to ever have them confused about where to go next. Something like, even some things like, say, Where's Wally, which is all about just density and confusion, and, you know, it does have a method to it if you can look beyond the surface stuff and see the structure of it. I like to do the kind of drawing that is well served by openness and by very upfront design features, which is one reason why I guess that kind of kids' books appeal to me, because there's something about honing a drawing down to its essence that makes it very satisfying for me. Doing something in as few lines as possible so that each line really counts for something, so that you can't, you know, take too many away. I mean, often that's kind of what you end up doing. You start off with a fairly dense thing and you take lines away and you take lines away until you're left with your actual drawing, like honing it out of a block of something. I really enjoy that. It's a kind of a zen kind of thing. Just removing.
Well, and I suppose intellectually, something like your book, Rumble Strips, is applying the language of comics to that sort of idea of simplicity, that if we can just boil it down to symbolism, you can still tell a story. And unlike a lot of artists, you seem to be putting into practice a lot of the arguments that Scott McCloud puts in his books about the way that, you know, there are all sorts of styles of telling comics, but not that many people are adventurous enough in using them.
Yeah, okay, I'll accept that. I think that there are a million ways you could tell stories in comics that people aren't doing, because they have a fixed idea about what comics are and what they can be. You could write about anything at all. I find it kind of, in a way, really sad that Rumblestrip should be seen as such a weird thing, just because it doesn't have protagonists in it, and it doesn't have a very obvious kind of a structure to it.
Ironically, it's probably like the kind of comic that more people see who don't read comics, when, you know, sort of escape instructions on how to get off a plane, for example, you know, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I felt that I wanted to do something that was going to expand my possibilities, and Rumblestrip could have been just ordinary, just a text, but it's all about seeing. Driving is all about seeing. It's all about signs and shapes and what's in front of you and the landscape and the buildings and the other cars, and it's all about looking at things and decoding things. So it had to be a comic, because that's the best way to get this kind of stuff across. And that seems to me to be a really obvious thing. And yes, I've been finding out it's not quite as obvious as all that. But it should be, you know. Yeah. It shouldn't be a cause for any kind of amazement that you could draw a comic about driving.
And also, I suppose, the fact that you're so comfortable with drawing comics that have a clear line and a design element to them meant that it was an ideal project for you in terms of drawing signs that are designed to be legible and clearly, you know, understood and have, you know, a decent design element to them.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, I had to go the opposite way. I had to be careful not to make it too clean and too designy, because I had made this decision to not have any people in it, because I wanted the reader to feel as if they were experiencing this themselves rather than experiencing it through a character. But what that meant was I had to try and make the drawings themselves have some kind of human feeling. So if I had made them as minimal and as rectilinear and as sharp as I might normally have done, then that would have been a bit too cold and a bit too alien. So I had to make sure that I didn't make them too perfect. So what I did a lot of the time was I drew things 3 or 4 times in order to keep that kind of spontaneous feeling. So in other words, I'd draw a page once, and then if it might look a bit too clean or something, I'd just draw it again and make sure that I got that kind of spontaneousness to it. So I tried not to do anything too nicely. My normal tendency would be to, like, you know, use a ruler to make sure the lines are straight and to make sure the perspective all matched up, and I had to kind of jettison all that and just think, no, just kind of draw it gesturally and make it feel like my thoughts coming out and not like a blueprint or something.
And in terms of pacing a story, obviously something like Rumblestrips has the luxury of being a graphic novel, so you can pace it differently than something you're producing on a weekly basis. So the discipline of doing a weekly comic like the DFC and then doing a graphic novel like Rumblestrips must be very different.
In some ways, yes, in some ways not, because if you're drawing a weekly strip, then either you're writing it week-week as you go along, or you write the whole thing in advance and then kind of draw it as fast as you can. With a completed thing like a novel, then it's the same kind of process. You can either draw it all at once, or you can do it over a long period of time and do it bit by bit. So they're not that different in some ways. I mean, obviously the main difference is that with a completed book, no one's going to see it until it's completely finished, whereas with a weekly comic, people see it almost as you're producing it, ideally, anyway. So with the strip I was doing for the DFC with Donny Digits, that was mostly finished by the time it appeared in DFC, because I did it for The Guardian first. Yeah. So I tried to be it, but I think when the first one came out, I was working on the 6th one when the first one was printed, because we all have this horror of being caught, you know, deadline-wise, and having to really be labouring. There's nothing worse than knowing that you've only got, you know, a day or 2 days or 3 days to get a strip done, because it kind of stops you feeling free enough to experiment. You just kind of have to do what you know will work and make sure that it's okay, because you haven't got time for it to go wrong. So you want to always give yourself a big enough cushion that you can maintain that freeness that you need to have to make something really good. Because if you're going to draw something that's going to be any good, you have to be able to surprise yourself a bit by trying things and just seeing if they're going to work or not. And you need to be able to feel free enough to do that. And if you haven't got a lot of time, then that often cuts down on that experimental impulse, because it's a bit scary, you know, because you can go out on a limb and then suddenly have no way to go back after you've tried something out and it didn't really work. So,
And you've done comics that are based on cartoons, like Sonic the Com... Well, I suppose a franchise that was a cartoon and a computer game but has cartoon elements to it, like Sonic the Comic and Echo the Dolphin. You've done comics that have then been turned into cartoons. And now your work in the Atomium is being displayed on screens. So there is this kind of back and forth dialogue between comic book imagery that we might see either animated or on a screen and on the printed page. I mean, how does that kind of like affect you?
I enjoy it a lot. The two worlds have a lot of similarities. I mean, they have their differences as well, but they're probably more similar than they are different. There's nothing to me more thrilling than seeing drawings moving, which is why I like animation so much, because it combines, you know, the thrill of the moving image with sound and music and everything that goes with it. Plus, it's drawings, which are the greatest form of expressing what's inside us. So, yeah, animation rocks. And comics can do the interior thing in a way that no other medium can do it. So you can look at it from both ends. You can look at the exterior, just the wonderfulness of the moving shape and the tension between the way the shapes work together and then release themselves. And then you can look at the comic and the way that that plays itself out over a whole page or a whole book. So yes, both forms kind of constantly go backwards and forwards. I find it instructive quite often to just pause animation and look at the in-between frames and look at the way that people construct those moments of compression and release to see how they do it. Because one of those things that we all understand instinctively about a comic is that the ones that really work are the ones where you draw how something feels rather than how it looks, so that there's always this sense of the interior thing being made into an exterior thing. And in animation, that's not so easy to do, because you have to sustain it over quite a long way. But with a comic, you can do that quite easily, because you don't have to make this thing internally consistent from all sides. So, yeah.
And the images of yours that are being displayed at the Atomium, is it recent work? Did you have any discussions with Paul about what work was going to be shown?
It's a mixture of things. Some of the stuff is relatively old. It's There's a couple of pages from Orson Welles' Special Agent, which is a project I did with Gordon Rennie for Tundra way back when, before Tundra went under. We were about halfway through it when they pulled the plug on us. So it's a big spread of the climax of the story where Welles is on top of the Hollywood sign, actually, along with a bunch of Nazis who are trying to trying to destroy Hollywood. They're going to blow it up. That's black and white, and it's quite a dramatic kind of big spread with these little figures on top of the big Hollywood letters. Although there's a bit of cheating going on, because in my research I discovered that the Hollywood sign itself is only very, very thin. The letters themselves, I mean, they're big, they're all, whatever they are, 30 feet tall, but they're only about, you know, 7 or 8 inches wide. So you couldn't really stand on top of them. So I had to pretend for the purposes of my story that you could, and I built these much wider ones. So that's kind of a cheat. But anyway, so that's one of the pictures. Then there's some stuff from Sugar Buzz, whereas we did this utopian story about this group of old-aged superheroes called the Ultra Spacers. And the idea was that they were all in their 70s and 80s, but they were still, you know, fighting crime with the aid of their exoskeletons and their and their super-developed costumes. The idea being that if they ever took the costumes off, then they'd probably just, you know, completely disintegrate because they were so old. But they never took them off, so they were able to just keep going. So I did a front cover for that was a classic kind of utopian kind of all the heroes together gazing up into the future. So that's one of another image. What else is there? Well, there's Donnie's in there, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Donnie Digits is in there.
So also all images in a way that are linked with technology up to a certain extent, which is kind of one of the themes of the Atom Style.
Yeah, it's about celebrating technology and about enjoying it and enjoying what it does for us, and that feeling of the future being full of amazing possibilities that are going to make our lives better and are going to be wonderful, you know, whether it's personal jetpacks and bubble cars and teleportation and, you know, all those kinds of things.
Cool. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Garen Ewing at the launch of his book, The Rainbow Orchid, at Foyles. I had a look at your career online, and it seems quite a sort of staccato career regarding comics, that you did an adaptation of The Tempest a few years ago, and there have been a few sort of small installments of The Rainbow Orchid in various small press publications before now, but this is kind of, it's been a while since you've done a full-length book and released it to the public. Have you had sort of artistic work in between, like, you know, graphic design, something that lets you at least pursue your activity, if not in a sort of sequential way in front of the public?
Yes, I've been working as an illustrator since about 2002. I mean, on and off before then, but full-time since 2002. I've been doing book covers, magazine illustrations, so that's been my bread and butter. And getting... The Rainbow Orchid, this volume one, I started in 1997, actually. Wow. but I only did 3 pages then. And then it continued in 2002. But as you say, because I was working with other illustration jobs, it's only when I found to fit it in, hence the very long time it's taken to get to this point. But all the work in volume one was finished in 2003, actually. Okay. So that's all quite old work, really.
Right. And have you spent the last 5 years trying to get it published, or was it because you knew you wanted to keep going with the story that if you published volume one when it was completed, you didn't want people to have to wait another 5 years for volume two?
I self-published it, and I was happy going along that route, really. And then when I realised that actually putting it on the web, which I did 2005 or something, I could actually have it in colour, and suddenly I got all these readers from all over the world, I thought, well, why publish it on paper, you know? It's just sort of a lot of hassle, extra expense. And, you know, I printed 500 of the first one, which was about as high as I could go. So I didn't really think about publishing it. When I finished it, I thought, I'll think about then. But I had no definite plan. But the reason it ended up getting published in a way was a publisher got in touch with me, Victor Gallants, which was a bit scary because they're a big publisher. I wasn't expecting it. And that led to me getting an agent, because a friend of Ellie's, actually, my wife, was an agent. And so I thought, just give me some advice. But they ended up taking me on. And so then I was in the system, if you like, the world of publishing, and just took off from there.
And you're an illustrator, but how long had you been drawing comics at this point? Was it something that you did alongside your illustration work throughout your career?
I've always done comics since I was a kid. You know, these sort of, a lot of comic people have, and it's always a passion. But I kind of gave up comics, actually, in a way. I went to the old UK Comic Art Convention with my portfolio, eventually built up to doing it, and kind of got a bit disillusioned with it. And that would have been, I can't remember. I couldn't tell you if it was the late 80s or the early 90s, okay. Somewhere around there anyway.
So perhaps a little bit too late, in the sense that the Westminster Comic Marts in the 80s were very much a fertile scene for up-and-coming British artists, you know, Paul Gravett's Fast Fiction Stall and all the careers that helped to launch, and various magazines that spun out of both his tenure and the people who took over from him. So maybe you literally were just a few years too late.
Well, I was self-publishing then, and Fast Fiction did take one of my very early comics, but that was towards the end, really, so I did kind of just miss that. Let me see. The UCAC experience was, I kind of thought, I suddenly realised if I wanted to be into comics as an artist, I'd be drawing all these other scripts, other people's writing, and I just didn't. It was it takes me so long to draw, I'm not fast, that I didn't think I'd be able to hack it, to be honest. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do comics, I just want to do something for my own enjoyment. Hence, I went back to, right, what do I really love? And I'm not going to bother trying to worry about getting a career in comics and stuff. So I went back to all the comics I loved as a kid, and then, you know, Tintin, Blake Mortimer, and all that Asterix kind of stuff. I thought, I'm just going to do that. And I did, and that's been fun. not like work, so, yeah.
I mean, I must say I'm not surprised that you say that it takes a long time to do your comics, because looking at the images we've got on the wall here in foils, it shows the amount of research that you do in order to get objects such as planes, interiors such as museums where the characters visit, entirely correct. I mean, how much research would you say went into this project as a whole?
Well, when I started, I thought I'm going to do it in a fictional 1920s so I can not be that accurate. Yeah, fudge it, exactly. But then I kind of wanted to get it right. It became more, actually became fun. But of course, once you start down that route, you start getting more and more into it and become more and more obsessed. For instance, the Natural History Museum scene, it took me ages to find what it looked like in the 1920s. But that's the kind of, there's this great satisfaction in it when you do it, but it does take a long time. You can spend half a day on the internet looking for something just to get on with the next line of the script, you know.
And would you say that the style that you draw your comics in now is a development of the style you've always had, or is it actually quite different to the way you first drew comics?
I think it's difficult to tell from my point of view, because I'm sort of on the inside looking out, as it were. It's more for others to say, I think it's the same. Well, no, it is different because I consciously went for that European clear line type look. But it's still, I'm not sort of referencing it as such. It's more my idea of it. People used to say, they look at my work, they say, oh, it looks like Brian Talbot's work. And The Tempest, I don't know if you've seen it, but that's really detailed. Maybe doing so much detail on that, I just thought, right, I've got all those little lines out of my system now. I can simplify a bit, you know.
Because this clear line style seems to be something that's very much a generational thing. It was very popular in the 1950s and then sort of came back in the late 70s and early 80s. And now again, there are people like you using it, Ritu Modan in her work. And of course, at the moment, there's the Atomium exhibition in Brussels that's showing a variety of Atom style artists from around the world. What do you think it is about this style that instead of being almost a constant, it's something that goes in and out of fashion?
I've never really thought about why it goes in and out of fashion. I mean, it's always been there on the continent. I mean, Tintin, of course, has always been popular. It's never really gone out of fashion. But there's elements to it, I think, are always going to be attractive to children and adults. I think adults can appreciate the graphic clarity of it. And for children, it's nice and simple and easy to understand visually. So, I don't think I could. I don't really have any view on its popularity.
Well, I mean, I suppose conversely, you could say, in a way, comics abandon children from time to time, and maybe that's why you don't see so many examples of the style in print.
Yes. Well, when I started Rainbow Orchid, which, as I said, was 97, most comics around at the time had the "for mature readers" stamp on it. And I did think, although I didn't really want to do it specifically for children, I wanted it to be okay for children. And that was a bit different then. There wasn't anything around really apart from Beano and the Dandy, which is a different sort of thing. And by the time it's actually come out, there is a lot more for children now. So it's kind of, it's not ahead of its time anymore. I'm not sure it was, but it was certainly, would have been quite a rare thing. I think at the time, Jason Cobley, who did the Bulldog Adventure magazine, he was thinking of doing a self-published comic for kids. The only problem with that is self-published comics are very difficult to distribute, and it's fine within the comics community, but getting them out to children who tend not to, especially then, you know, kids weren't really seen at conventions and stuff. I don't know if they are now much, but
Well, and in the meantime, the DFC has come and gone. You know, a comic that you contributed to, and I think a lot of people saw as the great white hope of children's comic publishing. And unfortunately, I guess it means that a comic that relies purely on subscription to work, just there isn't the market for that.
No, I guess, I don't know if, I mean, I know David Fickling wanted it to be, he knew it was going to be a long time to build. He was expecting a 3-year sort of build, which is quite a long time. And he was happy for it to be very slow to begin with. But yeah, obviously the financial climate put paid to that, so we never found out if it would have worked. I think the subscription model was the only way to do it for now. I know a lot of people complained about that, so why isn't it in the shops and stuff? But that wouldn't have been viable, and at least it existed. I think that's the thing. And I know he's I spoke to David a couple of weeks ago, and it's not left his head. You know, he's still got plans for it.
And when it came to contributing to the DFC, obviously you were producing a weekly strip. So how far in advance did you draw that so that you had a few episodes in the bank, as it were?
Well, I actually never appeared in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I was one of the early contributors.
Right.
But I went through a few ideas and I jumped a few projects from one to the other. And I had quite a busy year. All kinds of things got in the way. So... I actually only got about halfway through my strip, and of course they didn't want to publish it until it was finished. So that they wanted the whole thing finished. I think it was it would have been 12 parts. So that's kind of too short, really, for them to want to start running it, just in case, you know.
That kind of my follow-on question was going to be, how did that compare to doing a webcomic, which then obviously also comes out in installments?
Yes. Well, I was very lax with that as well. I'm not one for deadlines. When I was good, it was coming along weekly, and it was great for that. You know, people expected it to the next little strip to appear that week. But I never actually said I would do it weekly, so it gave me the option to miss it, which I did a lot. I never really got into the webcomic scene that much. It's very difficult to get into it. You really have to push yourself into it, you know, and be quite boisterous. And I found that quite difficult to do. I got a lot of hits, but it was mainly every now and then someone like PvP or Warren Ennis would link to it, and that's what gave it little boosts, and it would live off those for quite a long time.
Well, actually, I was going to mention Warren Ellis because you published a magazine in the 80s that included some of his early work.
Yes. Yeah, he did a 4-page strip, actually, with an artist who he wasn't too keen on. it's a very odd strip, actually. It's extremely surreal. It's funny, I was thinking about it just the other day. He did an interview as well in it, so I thought, I wonder if... I could get that online or something. People might be interested now. More interesting, I've got a 4-page letter from him with all doodles and everything, where he claims he's going to be the king of comics or the god of comics or something. It turned out not to be far from the truth. I thought he was being a bit, you know, grand about it. But he was right.
So as someone who's seen all sorts of aspects of publishing, from self-publishing comics, from publishing web comics, is it just a means to an end in a way, as long as you can kind of get your work out there?
Yes. I'm not a big webcomics fan, actually. I didn't really read that many. It's very convenient. And of course, you've got the colour thing, and you've got the readership is brilliant. And I've got an agent, but in a way, I pass on quite a few things to him because people find my website. And so the internet acts as a very good agent, actually. But yeah, I would have been happy continuing it on the web, I think, although, you know, it's books I like, so it would be nice to end up with that eventually.
And obviously the web version would have been quite differently formatted. Was it approximately half a page per sort of update?
As you can see from the panels on the walls here, they're in four tiers per page, so just one of those tiers works very nicely on a web page. Occasionally there's the half page bigger scenes, so I'd do them as a half page thing. But yeah, it worked better than a full page, I think. It was more like the strips just fit the web very easily. So that was luck. Happened to fit in quite nicely.
And obviously the format in general, which sort of leads on from the whole sort of clear line format, is very formalist. There's a certain number of panels per page. I mean, it varies, but you can see that you're sort of dipping in and out of, you know, a very clear sort of layout. Mm. Does that sort of formalism appeal to you in a way? Because once you've got that rigid structure, it means you can concentrate on other aspects of the art being important.
Yeah. I think I've got a very narrative style. It's kind of quite, it's almost like a documentary in a way. You're just looking at what's happening. You're not, there's not big panels or mad angles from above or people leaping out of the panels and stuff like that. So it's quite detached reading experience, possibly. Well, I've lost my train of thought now.
But, I mean, you know, the formalism, I suppose, allows you to concentrate on other aspects. I mean, looking at the pages we have here, the colour palette, for example, changes from page to page depending on, for example, the location or the different kinds of objects, you know, you're depicting, whether it's a part of the comic that's looking at, for example, the interior of a museum or one that's looking at something that's more technological-based.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other nice thing about the sort of very rigid sort of panel structure, which I think I find very attractive about the European graphic album, as it were, is that sort of repeating figures all over the page, which you don't get so much in, say, a superhero story, because you tend to have maybe three panels on many pages, because it's such a special thing. But I think it's very attractive, just having the same colours, and it's those lots of panels that produce that effect. It's quite pleasing from a sort of graphic design point of view, I think. But the palette, when I started, I'm not very good at colour, really. Well, it was actually Ellie, my wife, suggested I should, to help limit the palette to begin with, I used a Dulux Heritage, one of their paint cards, okay. And I just used those to begin with.
Which obviously is very evocative for creating a certain kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it's not brightly coloured. It's although I wanted a definite contrast between the scenes in England, which are a little bit overcast and grey and drab, and then when you get to India, it brightens up a bit, you know, so there's that sort of difference.
And as a fan of European graphic albums, is it very pleasing for you to see Volume 1 of the Rainbow Orchid in a graphic album format?
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, that would have been my ideal outcome. I'm not sure I ever thought it would happen. So, yeah, it's wonderful. And to be with the same publisher as Tintin in this country as well is quite nice. I'm sure that's why they picked it up, because it's sort of the market they know. So, yeah, lovely.
And I suppose that makes it appealing both to young audiences, as we've discussed, but also fans of, you know, the classic graphic albums. Mm. I mean, another kind of little tip of the hat I noticed in your work, I think, was the sound effects. Things like piff and paff seem very French rather than British, which I thought was really nice.
That's something I hadn't considered, actually, but now you say it, you're right, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, most people said to me that if I got a publisher, it would probably be in Europe before I got it published in Britain. So it's kind of nice that didn't happen, obviously. I mean, it's quite a British comic, actually. It's someone said it was Anglo-Franco-Belgian.
it's as British as Poirot.
Yes. Yeah, perhaps it is.
And how many volumes is it going to run to? I mean, presumably they're going to be various stories leading with the main character.
Yeah, well, for the Rainbow Orchid, it's three volumes, which is all one story. And as to whether there will be any more, I'm not sure yet. Hopefully this will do well enough and there will be. I'd probably like them to be just one volume, adventures from then on, more manageable. But I kind of already started this already. So, yeah.
Cool. Fingers crossed it does really well.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks.
For more info about Garen and Woodrow's comics, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. where you'll find links to both of the creators. In the next episode of Panel Borders, I'm talking to Paul Gravett about curating the exhibition, which includes examples of Woodrow's work and others, at the Atomium in Brussels. Thanks for listening.